Hi, Michael.
Hi, Bob.
How you doing?
I'm all right. How are you?
I'm not too bad. Let me introduce us. I'm Robert Wright of Blogging Heads TV. This is an episode of Worldwise. You are Michael Idov in Moscow, actually, and you are editor-in-chief of GQ Russia, as I understand it. Anything else you want to say by way of introducing yourself?
No, I think that describes me pretty well at this point.
Okay. And we're talking to you because something pretty important just happened in something that used to be part of what we used to call Russia, which was actually the Soviet Union. There were elections in Georgia, and the guy who's been president for, I guess, about 10 years or so, Saakashvili, I think is roughly the pronunciation, has lost. And the winner is someone whose name is no easier to pronounce, so maybe I will leave that to you. Who's the new president of Georgia?
All right, well, let's make a few corrections right off the bat. Okay. It wasn't a presidential election, it's a parliamentary election. Ivanishvili, the presumed winner, and they're still counting out the votes, it's about 25% of the vote counted at this point. The winner apparent, Bidzina Ivanishvili, is the leader of the coalition that ran a number of candidates on various city and regional levels for the parliament. Now, the way the Georgian government works is, Saakashvili's coalition having lost in the parliamentary election, this might mean and is expected to mean Saakashvili stepping down and calling for a sort of a snap presidential election or referendum.
Let me see if I understand this, because normally when it's a parliamentary election that leads someone to become the leader, normally the title is prime minister. But
yes.
Saakashvili is the president, right? So you're saying
yes.
You're saying this will lead to a subsequent presidential election that the challenger is now pretty much guaranteed to win, or you're saying that the nomenclature is different, and in this parliamentary system, it so happens they're called president instead of prime minister?
No, you got it right in the first one.
Okay.
That's exactly what it is. So theoretically, in pure theory, there exists a possibility of, a Georgia with Ivanishvili for, serving as the prime minister and Saakashvili as president, but obviously this is not going to happen.
I see. Okay.
Right.
So what is the import of this? I'm sure there are a lot of important things about it, but the kind of, the kind of cartoon version of it, or one cartoon version, is kind of pro-Western president will be replaced by, or pro-American, by a less pro-Western and more pro-Russian candidate. That's the way it's being depicted in some places. Is that a way to at least start talking about what the actual significance is?
Well, in the narrow, very narrow sense that this description provides, it is not incorrect. Saakashvili has made a huge deal over the last 9 years or so of being pointedly pro-Western. Tbilisi has, George W. Bush highway, and the entire country is kind of a George W. Bush highway in the sense that it's it's almost an experiment in kind of extremely laissez-faire market economy and sort of the Chicago school rules there. And it was successful in a way because, in the ease of doing business rating, Georgia went up from 112th place to 12th place in just 3 years under Saakashvili. So it's certainly a great playground for libertarian Western ideas. That said, this is not all Saakashvili is. He's also, a very Eastern or, let's say, post-Soviet-style authoritarian ruler who's installed a lot of his cronies in power and controls the media, controls most of the large businesses, except, of course, Ivanishvili's businesses, etc., etc. Meanwhile, Ivanishvili, as you know correctly pointed out, is seen as more pro-Russian for the simple reason that he made all his money in Russia. And for the, you know, for a large part of his life, this is a man who called himself Boris, Boris Ivanishvili, which is obviously a Russified version of his Georgian name, Bidzina. And I've met him for a story that I did for GQ Russia that in English it's available on the New Republic's website, tnr.com. Right. And for the story, I when I interviewed him, I actually asked him up front, you know, are you a Putin guy? And he swears up and down he's not. In fact, there was a brief sort of kind of off the record-ish section of our interview. It wasn't explicitly off the record. That's why I can sort of repeat it now that he said that he's actually he's been uncomfortable with Putin, and it's not a coincidence that he has left Russia and spent a few years in France shortly after Putin came to power. And it does sound convincing that he's not a Putin guy. All the same, he's reluctant to criticize Russia. And when I pushed him to admit that Russia has at least as many political problems and problems with the electoral process as Saakashvili's Georgia, he sort of demurred and said, yeah, of course it does, but, you know, I shouldn't be criticizing them right now. We have to deal with our own stuff first.
Mm-hmm. Okay, now I want to ask you in a second kind of what difference it makes to the United States and the world at large. In other words, what kinds of policy changes might you expect from a truly pro-Russian Georgian president, if that turns out to be the inclination? But first, maybe we should give a little historical background for people who have only a dim memory of the war in 2008, very brief kind of military conflict between Russia and Georgia over a couple of some parts of Georgia that Russia thinks of as legitimately Russian, you know, in character, and that Russia thinks of as independent of Georgia, south of Sechia is one of them, and then there's another one, right? There was a right, and this was perceived in America as kind of Russians inexcusably more or less invading Georgia. America was very much on balance on Georgia's side, although America chose not to intervene on Georgia's behalf, perhaps to Saakashvili's disappointment. But what's your kind of capsulized version of what actually happened there?
It was a game of fairly idiotic brinksmanship on both sides, and each side was sort of daring the other to go further, and then the tanks rolled. That's sort of how these things happen these days. It was striking nonetheless, and Russia, of course, just by the virtue of being, you know, this enormous power, was probably, you know, on the whole, in the wrong there. But then again, you know, also you have to remember that this was preceded by sort of a sneaky passportization of Abkhazians and South Ossetians, where Russians would, you know, give out Russian passports to the people living in the region in order to bolster the claim that this is not Georgia. And the Georgians are fairly broken up about it still. But at the same time, you know, it's interesting. In all my conversations with Georgians during the trip that I made there to report this story, I noticed that there's no animosity for they don't feel animosity toward Russia. I think a lot of them are just being realistic about it, and, you know, are saying that, yeah, America may support us from afar, but the Russians are the ones that love our wine. They're the ones that would come and, you know, spend their money here.
So there's strong economic engagement with Russia that tends to kind of consolidate ties.
Oh God, yes. Are you kidding me? Georgia makes this mineral water, Berzhomi. It's this salty, slightly weird mineral water that's absolutely beloved by Russians. Now, with the relationship between Putin and Saakashvili being what it is, the sales of Berzhomi, just like the sales of Georgian wine, are officially banned in Russia. You have to realize that every week of this embargo, Georgia is losing at least hundreds of thousands, probably millions of dollars, just not being able to, you know, to sell Berzhomi and Georgian wine to Russians, especially since Georgian wine is, I'm going to get in a lot of trouble, I think, for saying this, but I think Russians are just about the only ones who consider Georgian wine drinkable outside of Georgia. There are some good wineries there, but
so,
on the whole,
so meanwhile, just to wrap the one thread up, what was and is the status of the disputed provinces, South Ossetia and one other one? I mean, they are, I guess, predominantly, I assume, ethnically Russian, and Russia is the dominant language. And is it the case?
No, not true.
Not quite?
No, not quite. They're separate people. They're not, you know, in fact, Abkhazians and South Ossetians. Those are ethnicities.
But so, is Russia the language that's the Russian as opposed to Georgian, the language that's spoken there?
It varies village to village. You can't really make these generalizations. I would be uncomfortable making them.
Okay, and so what is their status? I mean, they are for legal
their
purposes.
Their status, they're self-proclaimed independent states whose independence is, you know, has been recognized by Russia and I think a couple other countries. And,
did they vote in this election?
No, they didn't vote in the election.
They didn't vote. So though America considers them part of Georgia, those people did not vote in this election.
I don't believe they did, no.
Okay, so even without them, a candidate perceived in some quarters as pro-Russian won, so that must confirm what you just said, which is that by and large the Georgians are pretty happy with Russia.
They're not happy with Russia. They want to trade with Russia.
Okay.
Very different. And just it's real politics, really. They don't want this embargo. They know that Russians, ordinary Russians, are glad to come and spend their money there in the way ordinary Americans, you know, won't. So that's a huge thing there, especially since the unemployment rate in Georgia is very high and jobs are a huge problem. And I've actually seen this sort of myself, the way Ivanishvili, after flirting with the sort of the nationalist message, you know, a kind of like Georgia for Georgians type thing that he tried to do early in his campaign, switched later, partly on the advice of the polling firm that he hired, an American polling firm whose name political junkies will know very well. It's Penn Schoen Berland, the Mark Penn's polling firm. Mm-hmm. So on their advice, he switched his message to jobs, and that message resonated much better than sort of his early nationalist and traditional message. I think one thing to know about his message is that I've witnessed this. He and his people would basically just engage in kind of pure populism, just in its purest form. You know, whatever you want us to say, we'll say. Which is what makes one a little nervous about, okay, what is he now actually going to do now that he's in power?
Okay.
Assuming he's in power.
Yeah, and you actually interviewed him and wrote this piece that we will link to, which is on the New Republic website. So I'm going to ask you about your impressions in a second. But first of all, to get back to that other question, are there particular issues that could be kind of pivotal, where we're now wondering which way he will go, and issues that Americans in particular might be concerned with?
I think, and this is a nice segue to sort of his, you know, description of his character, I think his affinity for Russia is not something that the Americans should be concerned with. I think everything else is, because he's a genuine eccentric, and it's very hard to understand how exactly, how into the whole governing thing he is. Whether he
How into governing he is.
Yeah, because it is quite possible that he just sort of ran to see if he could win, and now he did.
I see. So it's unclear how into governing he'll be, you're saying.
Well, he is a person who's used to throwing money, his own money, at the problems. And,
yeah, he's a billionaire, we should say. He has several billion. He has his
more
wealth
than
supposed...
$6 billion dollars.
And the GDP and the GDP of Georgia is about twice that, right?
Exactly. His wealth is almost half of Georgia's GDP. So he used it in order to solve some problems that are normally solved through, you know, through the public sector. He would personally buy gas for police cars. He would personally restore Georgia's theaters. He would personally, you know, put whole cities on a kind of stipend and pay people's pensions. Obviously, this is not the way actual governance works. So it remains unclear whether he understands that it's not going to be like this, that he's not going to be the czar of Georgia.
So is one of your concerns whether and we should say, first of all, that a big piece of good news here is that it seems as if there's going to be a peaceful democratic transition. Georgia is, after all, a young democracy. And Saakashvili had himself come to power in I forget what color, the Rose Revolution or something. So that's good news. But am I sensing that part of your concern is whether this is the right person to really consolidate that legacy and keep Georgia on the up and up and as far as being a kind of liberal democracy goes?
Yeah. By the way, my reporter friends and I are trying to start calling this the Zebra Revolution. Let's see if it will take or not. Because you know he collects zebras. Well, he only has two, but two zebras are clearly better than none. To respond to your question, it could be Saakashvili's sort of defining legacy, letting go of power peacefully and in a sort of a supremely civilized manner. It's something that he's already being commended on. And I saw Joe Tripp tweet about it, and I saw some Washington-type reactions that were very, very positive about that. And I think that... Mm-hmm. In history, he will be forgiven for a lot of indiscretions that happened between 2003 and 2012, especially between 2008 and 2012 when he started sort of actively consolidating his power. I think he will be forgiven for a lot of it, and I think this will burnish his legacy very uh-huh. well.
So there had been concerns that he himself was not good for democracy. He I guess, had some authoritarian tendencies. But the concern is now that his successor may as well. Does his successor control a certain amount of media in Georgia?
He has one TV channel, Channel 9.
Okay. And is that, how important is that? That's just...
It's pretty important. There's actually a great anecdote about the campaign that involves his TV channel, because since the government-controlled TV channels would not would not show Ivanishvili or transmit his message in any way. And in fact, I've spoken to people who worked at PIC, one of Saakashvili-controlled channels, and they couldn't even bring themselves to say the name of Ivanishvili out loud. They would sort of automatically lower their voices when talking about him. So since that was the case, Ivanishvili did what he always does, threw money at the problem. He bought 40,000 satellite dishes. Channel 9 is a satellite channel. And just handed them out for free. Now, the government somewhat reasonably said he was trying to bribe the electorate and ordered the satellite dishes taken down. So this is something that can only happen during, you know, the election season in a very small country, because what you had next was Saakashvili's police forces just roaming villages and personally making people one by one, you know, door to door, making them take down Ivanishvili's satellite dishes. So this sort of tragic comedy of it is quite something.
Okay. Now, so give us your personal impressions of Ivanishvili, if that's the way you pronounce it. You actually went out to his, I guess, slightly bizarre estate. Is that right? I mean, presumably that's where he keeps the zebras, or not?
Yes. Well, he has three estates. All of them are slightly bizarre. One is in Tbilisi. It's kind of a modern architectural masterpiece, although it's a little crazy. It has all these sort of globes and glass rhombuses, and that's where he keeps his art. He owns some, you know, Damien Hirst and other incredibly expensive pieces, and he's actually the owner of Dora Maar, the Picasso that sold for a record record amount of money in 2006 at Christie's, I believe. He was the anonymous buyer, so presumably that's where it is, and Tbilisi somewhere in a vault. Then he also has a castle in his native village, Chert Villa. He also has this compound that I've visited near Batumi on the Black Sea coast of Georgia. And that one has, his summer house and a giant water park that he built for his children. It actually looks like, you know, a whole amusement park with like a giant Six Flags type water slide and all that. And he also has the zebras and a little zoo with a lot of parrots. I think he has dozens and dozens of parrots. Yeah, in Chert Villa he has a kangaroo. So yeah, there are these bizarre mini zoos that he keeps everywhere he lives.
He sounds a little like Michael Jackson. I hope the parallel doesn't extend too far.
Well, his moonwalking is terrible.
Yeah. Okay. Good. That's reassuring. Strangely. So he made his money in Russia, you said, in the electronics business or something? He went to Russia when he was a young man?
Yes, he went to Russia right after college because, as he told me, this was the only way to make any money or to have a career. There were just no jobs in Tbilisi in the sort of late Soviet period. And he fell into the electronics business, and from 1988 to 1990, he sold computers, mostly wholesale, and he says that this was because the computers were not the business that was sort of on the racketeer's radar yet. So mm-hmm. he was able to sell them to institutes and to colleges and to research labs without being hassled by the sort of the nascent organized crime. And then by 1990, when they started pressuring him, he's already made enough money to switch businesses, and he and two of his friends opened a bank, Российский кредит, the Russian credit, which he owned until very recently, who was a part owner, and I think sold his share in it for something close to $1 billion.
Mm-hmm. And you seem to consider him eccentric. In the course of your exposure to him, what would you say are the eccentricities that might seem most inauspicious for his career as the leader of Georgia?
Well, I mean, we can talk about the small things like, you know, his sort of belief in kind of extreme attachment parenting and all that, but those would be just anecdotes, I think.
Yeah, that means that he sleeps, that his kids at a very young age slept in the bed with him and his wife, right?
Yes, up until like 8 years old or something.
Yeah. Oh, 8 years old. Well, that is kind of pushing the envelope.
I think I don't think that's relevant, though. I think we're just trading in kind of anecdotes right now. I think what is relevant is, like many very successful people, he honestly believes that he has understood human nature on a deeper level than most people can. Like, he honestly thinks that he has cracked the code of human behavior in general. He says he's written a book about it, his own book of sort of his private philosophy. It's unpublished. We can probably look forward to it being published now that
Do you have a sense for what his deep insight into human nature is? Does he have a grand theory that you're aware of?
You know, I tried pushing him on that, and he just ended up sounding kind of hippie-ish on it. It was basically just, you know, love, and people need love, and this sort of thing. So, at the same time, he's obviously rather conservative, or traditional, let's say traditional, when it comes to, you know, family and things of that nature. He has, early in the campaign, he has allowed himself some homophobic remarks, which it's hard to say now whether they were just sort of red meat for the countryside crowd or something he really believes. So it's unclear, but I think that the main takeaway from this is that he operates from this place of ultimate knowledge. I don't think that he's the kind of guy who's used to, you know, hearing no. I don't think he's the kind of guy who's used to hearing you're wrong and the facts say otherwise. So to see how this will play out is obviously something that we need to pay a lot of attention to that, because I think he has sort of the seeds of autocracy, you know, right there, like they're in the open. I don't think he. When I asked him about this, he said something about, yeah, I know, my people are so sort of childish and impulsive, and they think I'm the Messiah, and of course I'll disappoint them, but, you know, but I think that I'll do whatever's possible. And I wasn't even trying to say that. It's just, he says it as if it's a liability, but at that point, you know, the numbers showed that 38% of Georgians even knew who he was. So for him to, you know, back in July to say, oh yeah, my people think I'm the Messiah, but no, I'm just human, you know, that shows you something, right?
Well, does it tell you that he actually thinks he's the Messiah?
Well, I'm not his psychologist. And also, when I asked him about psychology, he said that he used to support this sort of psychoanalytical circle he financed. One, and I asked him whether he's been to a therapist himself, and he said, no, in fact, my therapist friends tell me that I am the only sane man in the world. So there.
That is the most dangerous delusion of all, possibly. Well, and is the Georgian political system such that he is going to have to concede power to others and work with other people very extensively? In other words, democracy as we think of it has sufficiently taken root that and division of power within the government that autocratic tendencies will not get him very far, if indeed he tries to manifest those tendencies.
Well, the interesting thing about that is that he keeps insisting that he will only serve out 2 years. And I know his American, you know, polling firm just begged him to stop saying that because it's a terrible pre-election message. But, you know, he appears to have won with it. So there. He told that to me as well. He says that he's only in it for 2 years. He'll put a good team in place and then he'll retreat back into the private sector. It remains to be seen, obviously, whether this is true, but that alone shows you that, you know, he might not be entirely serious about this. He might delegate a lot.
Mm-hmm. And I guess by definition, given the way the system works, he will have to have a fair amount of support in the legislature to become president, as I now understand it, as I understand it.
Right, but I think that this sort of event has its own momentum. I think that if he wins decisively enough, you know, now his coalition wins, I think the presidency could be his for the taking.
Mm-hmm. Okay. And there was one incident you alluded to in your piece that's published on the New Republic website, I think. The one thing that was possibly important in his getting elected was some kind of prison abuse or prison rape scandal.
Right.
What was that?
Well, that was their version of the October surprise, except this, you know, was the September surprise because the election was on October 1st. On September 18th, viral videos were shown on Georgian television of inmates being abused and tortured and violated in a Tbilisi jail. And one of them was, in fact, an Ivanishvili supporter and a prisoner who was instrumental in getting the video footage out was an Ivanishvili supporter. So it's, I don't know whether this is something, this is sort of the trump card that they had up their sleeve all along, or it's a bit of serendipity, but that's what happened. Obviously, that pushed the public opinion, you know, away from Saakashvili. But I have to point out that Saakashvili, when pressed, you know, when pressured to act, does seem to act honorably, because what happened was it was shown on television on Ivanishvili's Channel 9, of course, but also you know, on one another station that was you know, that was government controlled, and it was followed by the immediate firing of at least two cabinet level ministers. So there's a pattern where you can see, you know, that Saakashvili was you know, a clear autocrat, but there's a line that he won't cross, and we've seen it with the scandal that was allowed to be made public. Mm-hmm. And not remain just, you know, just a rumor or something on the internet. And I think we're seeing it again with the resignation today.
Okay. And now the question is whether the his successor will comport himself in a comparable way, with kind of comparable respect for the mechanisms of liberal democracy, I guess. So it sounds to me as if there aren't, you know, there are not a lot of big issues that at least loom large in the American policy horizon where he will be decisive. I mean, I'm not a, you tell me, are there some big Georgia / America issues to be resolved or not resolved? Or is it more that, you know, what America might like is, like, let's not have a war between Georgia and Russia? Is
right,
that, you know?
Right. But at the same time, Saakashvili was sort of a known quantity. You know, this guy can go either way. So I think that America, when it comes to this region, prefers to err on the side of stability and predictability above all. Because it's a volatile region, and to have somebody whose actions you can predict, even if these actions are not, you know, 100% kosher, is actually worth a lot to the states. So in Ivanishvili, they have somebody largely unpredictable at this point. As for issues that directly involve Americans, well, we'll see how populist he's going to be. For example, he might have an issue with American bases in Georgia. There's, you know, there's a contingent of American soldiers in Georgia, so, you know, there might be something there. But I don't think it's going to be anything anything crucial, anything that would somehow make the U.S. view Georgia in a sort of strikingly different light.
And was there any discussion in the campaign of him actually resolving the issue with the two disputed provinces?
I think that's something that, you know, will probably be kicked down the road for now.
Okay. And finally, in your travels in Georgia, did you happen to get a sense for what the prevailing attitudes towards America there are?
I think this is something that we talked about earlier. I think that Georgians are generally grateful for the American support, but I think they perceive it as something largely abstract. And Saakashvili's souring reputation sort of influenced the American reputation as well, because they see Saakashvili and, you know, and America as almost one and the same. In that sense, I think they like America and they're grateful to America, but at the same time, they would love to see more Russian tourists, you know, sunning themselves on their beaches than American consultants drafting their legislation.
Okay. That's understandable, I guess. Okay. But it sounds like in some ways, I mean, if America indeed cares about the spread of liberal democracy, there is some good news here, an apparently successful, peaceful transition.
Absolutely. That is actually a tremendous piece of news, and I think we should emphasize it a little more, because this was the first peaceful transfer of power in Georgia through elections, and that alone is something to congratulate the Georgians for. Absolutely.
Okay. Well, then we can close on a positive note. Thank you so much for taking the time, Michael. And
Thanks,
I hope we'll have a chance to talk again.
I'd love that. Thank you.
Okay. Thanks.
All right.
Bye-bye.